Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the AEW Dynamite Review. I'm Adam Wilborn from What Culture, joined in person by the Dudley Boys of What Culture, Mike Pavlo and Michael Sidgwick, here to review everything that happened on last night's episode of AEW Dynamite. But before we get into your plan of this sort of thing, make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling on either iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts from, for daily wrestling podcasts where we not only review Dynamite, but also AEW Rampage, Raw, SmackDown, NXT. Pay-per-views, premium live events. We have interviews, roundtable discussions, and a roundup of the week complete with a very good quiz, of course, on wrestle culture. As I said, joined by Hanful and Sidgwick to review AEW Dynamite. I am a little bit giddy because it's the first time we've all been back in a room together for about 3 weeks, it feels like. But Sidg, a mixed bag sounds like a backhanded compliment. A roller coaster of a Dynamite with a lot of highs.
A lot of highs. The lull didn't really last very long, and I thought the main event was tremendous. Oh. I'm the high guy on this main event. I thought it was unbelievable. Not like a five-star match or anything, just in terms of sheer action and compact exhilaration in a digestible package. I thought was tremendous. Wasn't even the best part of the show. There were several candidates for that. The ugly stuff, while minimal, was particularly ugly. Usually the drab bit can sometimes go for like half an hour, and you're like, oh, hey, man. It was like a short jolt of really ugly consecutive stuff, and then it was just good again. So I wouldn't say uneven, I would say mostly excellent, but my God, the ugly stuff was ugly.
Yeah, I'm going to repeat something I said on Twitter, but I haven't got a catchphrase for it. So I'll
just the mega fans?
The Partridge, like, sorry. But I'm going to
sure
say
they'll forgive him.
I shut up, my new cock.
During that first hour last night, and I loved a lot of the Dynamite first hours in the run-up to between All Out and Full Gear, which certainly felt like a bit of a peak period for AEW.
So what cereal did you pair this with?
I had some chocolate orange. They're called Crave. Kellogg's are the brand.
Aldi.
Ones, but the Aldi ones, the chocolate orange. They're called like chocolate orange pillows, which is a lovely name for cereals as well. But they're those little wheat things with chocolate inside, but they're orangey tinted. They're unbelievable.
Sorry, just to clarify here, you've been off with the COVID, right?
I had it, and then one of my kids and the wife had it.
And you're all back to normal. That's great. It's fantastic
good.
And all that.
Taste buds back.
And you and I are, along with Andy Murray, in a group attempting to lose weight. And you had what?
Chocolate orange cereal, but like I'm trying to follow their instructions.
You had it with skimmed milk, right?
Did I balls?
Skim milk is a fraud.
It's bollocks.
Just get green milk. It's a reasonable compromise in your life. Like blue milk is great.
Get blue milk.
You get blue milk.
Blue milk.
Oh, fancy!
I've gone oat on hot drinks for the added flavour. Like oat milk with a latte is quite nice. Get involved. But the box says 12 servings, and I'm actually going to try and keep it to 12 because I tend to complete those boxes in six.
Challenge accepted.
It's like, you know, people post their Elden Ring stats. I should just post cereal boxes. Done it.
Complete in six. So.
No, this was, I tweeted this last night. I found the elements of the first hour so life-affirming that I started thinking of the people that still refuse to watch this because they're waiting for it to go rubbish. So they can like, see, told you it'd be absolutely terrible. Like, yeah, you missed out on like 3 or 4 years of all of us losing our goddamn minds at this great wrestling show. Every theme that hit, every development, every action, everything that was teased over that, like I would say the first 45 to 50 minutes of the show was, and I've said phrases like this on these reviews before, the reason you watch pro wrestling. More patient to WWE's ills than my esteemed colleague, but I know what I watched that for. I watched this for the best professional wrestling, and there was repeated examples of that over that first hour that just made me so glad that AEW existed. That's when AEW, I think, is at its best. When a theme music comes on, you're like, oh, it's this guy. We previewed the card yesterday, and I was like, it's this. I didn't know we had this. I did. I'd just been allowed to forget because I was just so immersed in the last bit. It's magic when it's like that. I would agree with Sidgwick. I don't think that this wasn't necessarily a Dynamite two halves. The lulls weren't long, but a couple in particular were so important that you make you angry because it took you away from the joy of some of the good stuff.
Yeah, it was. It wasn't something that ruined the entire show, but it was. What's it called? What do diamonds have? The issues with the diamond. Basically,
blood on them.
No. There's some problems with it, basically, and it's like that takes away from the whole thing. But the whole thing is still far better than the other options. I want to give a shout out to, is it Kevin Blackwood on Twitter? I think it is. Mm. People will be like, AEW fans will pop for anything. Like, noticeably enjoying being a wrestling show you paid to go to is a bad thing. I love that take. It's just preposterous.
It's just gutted. People are just gutted that people like it.
Mm. It might rebound as well. It will go rubbish for like a sustained period eventually.
A reason why we do the podcast like we did when months ago when everyone's like, oh, you paid WWE shills all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Where we're like, this isn't good. This needs to change. You know, this amount of interruptions or whatever it may be. Flaws. That's what the word I was looking for when it comes to diamonds. Yeah. And then when we have things like this, then that's the balance.
Is it the diamonds in the rough? Are you getting any metaphors?
No. Like the flaws in a diamond, basically, is what I mean in terms of still a diamond. It's just got some issues with it. And the reason why we do have the ones where we nitpick on certain episodes of Dynamite is because you can have elements like this first hour.
Yeah, absolutely. Hold them to the highest standard and the highest standard will be maintained.
Be honest, were you going to watch this live before Tony Khan's tweet about Punk and Harwood?
He got me to stay up. He absolutely got me to stay up. Like there, especially because I'm sure he alluded to it, or I just made it headcanon in my own mind that this was going to open the show. I'm pretty sure he said, we're going to kick Dynamite off of this. And I was like, yeah. I'm
surprised you managed to get a flight to America that late, to be honest.
Well, I know, yeah. This is the thing. And did you know that they put the American food adverts on the big screen when you're watching Dynamite in the building as well? Incredible.
Right, let's dive straight into it with CM Punk versus Dax Harwood. I love CM Punk cutting promos, but I like watching him wrestle even more. So this was a fair compromise compared to what we preview. But stop tweeting after we've done the preview, Tony, okay? Tweet a little bit earlier, mate.
We're going to have to introduce a new component to the preview because this is a strategy that they've been doing for quite some time, the late-in-the-day announcement of something awesome, so we can predict what awesome thing is going to happen after we press stop record.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the early NXT things, wasn't it? Early war strategy was them tweeting half the card at 11:30 at night over here before AEW Dynamite went on the air, just be like, I know you were going to watch this, but you've just updated your feed and this graphic's newer. Watch this instead.
So back and forth early on, but it's back and forth between Punk and Harwood, so it's always enjoyable to watch. Dax takes Punk into the sauna and just chops him a bit, but then Punk slams back and goes for Harwood's arm. Dax hits him with a knee lift, returning fire, and goes after Punk's neck and midsection. He's selling something from, 2.5 weeks ago still? Yep. Brilliant. The Gun Club, dressed preposterously, are at ringside, heckling and sort of distracting Dax to feed in something we'll get back to later on. Dax goes for the diving headbutt, but Punk moves out of the way, and Punk hits Dax with a drop kick. That gets a near fall. They fight on the top rope. Punk sends Dax down to the mat and goes for the big elbow drop, but Dax pops up immediately and crotches Punk over the top rope. Superplex, and this time he managed to execute the diving headbutt for a two count. Dax goes to suplex him, but Punk blocks it, and they do that bit where they both topple over the top rope, and I'm worried about everyone dying, to be perfectly honest. Out comes Cash Wheeler to support his mate, but they get back in the ring. Punk hits a diving crossbody when Dax kicks out of that. He puts in the Anaconda Vice, but Dax manages to roll out and goes for the sharpshooter, and there's an exchange of cradles. Dax counters Punk's rising knee into this bonkers rope-bouncing power bomb for a near fall. But then Punk hits his knee strike, goes to the GTS, but Dax blocks it and puts him in the sharpshooter. Punk manages to transition, though. Anaconda Vice. Dax taps. Punk celebrates and signals. Well, if you're Excalibur, some title, one of the titles, the world title. He did a Hangman Page reference as well. What are your thoughts on the opener, Hamlet?
I thought this was beautiful. I thought this was absolutely beautiful. This was, like, as you've articulated there, just a really elegantly worked pro wrestling match on its own terms. Let's ignore a little bit that this was like on the surface, going to be a love letter to Bret the Hitman Hart, booked as it was on the 25th anniversary to the date of Hart Austin from WrestleMania 13, which in itself was knowing, because as like we've talked before about like Cedric's birthday match, but like Tony Khan, I'm not saying he does this stuff directly for us, but he is a wrestling fan that does this for other people, and he spotted this, and the wrestlers themselves might have spotted it, asked for it, whatever. However this came about, there was an immediate Bret Hart feeling in the air, and in reality, they didn't like labour too much on that in the match. Of course there was elements, you knew there was going to be a sharpshooter. I liked even the attempt at the sharpshooter when Punk first tried to push the leg away. That was enough for me. And there was like other little details that they applied to the match. The suplexes that were being fired off were Bret Hart suplexes. The superplex in particular was a very Bret Hart superplex. CM Punk sells. I think I've worked out why I love CM Punk selling so much, because this has been a feature of his comeback. CM Punk sells the match he's in, the feud he's in, and the 7 years he took off all in one. That's what he's doing. And I think that's why I've been struggling to articulate what it is that has separated him from everybody else and just how great his selling is. Certainly in a way to try and describe it as a viewer. And you were watching him. You pointed out about like selling the pain of the dog collar match, which, oh my God, like that match is more dangerous than Blood and Guts in AEW lore right now, the way that it was played out, the way it was booked, executed, and the way that it's now being sold. But so he's selling that, right? He has suffered through that match. So he's selling the big CM Punk story, which is he's just come out of a Blood and Guts, of a dog collar match, and he wants a title match. He's selling the intricacies of this specific match and the work that Dax has done to his back and his various other body parts and the wear and tear of a standard wrestling match, which is going hard, which is what these two are. And he's selling the fact that he is still, you know, relatively fresh off not doing this for 7 years, not falling down for 7 years, and how much that must hurt to be back doing that. And the way he just weaves it all together, it never feels fake. It never feels a little bit like as it did earlier on. It's like, wow, he has just got a sweat on because this is physically tiring. He's new to this. He's now performing.
Grizzled.
I believe this to be him performing that version of selling rather than just, oh, Christ, that took you out of me, Darby. This is all different. This is the art.
Like after Christmas when you run up the stairs.
Yeah, this is the art of the work rather than physically just struggling through it. Dax Harwood remains like one of the best ever singles wrestlers to be predominantly a tag wrestler. I think
yes.
There is just mounting evidence that Dax Harwood is the great singles wrestler that loves another form of wrestling more, and more power to him.
Another one for the TNT title list.
Oh, there's too many. There are too many.
So this wasn't a tribute to Bret Hart in spots. This was a tribute to Bret Hart in being f***ing excellent. That was what this was. And fair play to them both. They tweeted afterwards, I love Bret more. No, I love him more. Bret Hart loves this more because he didn't necessarily need to see a love letter to himself like a certain other person does, as Cedric alluded to. He needs to see great wrestling because that's what he loves, and that's what this was. Excalibur. CM Punk is probably gesturing for Hangman Page's title because he doesn't want one with jizz encrusted on it. Love this. Couldn't have loved it more.
I couldn't have loved it more. It wasn't a match of the year contender in terms of its quality, but then I also loved it to death, can't find a single fault with it, and thought it was absolutely perfect for what it was. Yes, it never veered into Bret Hart cosplay, which the most cynical observers might have thought it was going to. They obviously did some SummerSlam 1991 inspired sequences with the headlock takeovers and the like, but it never, other than the sharpshooter tease, it wasn't cosplay, it was just working at Bret Hart, a match that Bret Hart would love rather than a Bret Hart match. I was so full of praise for this because it was just so compact and it did everything it had to do without compromising itself. They sold everything so well and yet never to the detriment of like a really furious, blistering pace. Like it's just genius craftsmanship, the likes of which you can't really analyze that well or better than they can just simply get on with doing. It wasn't spectacular and blew away in terms of action and the moves, but everything was threaded together so nicely. It didn't waste anything either.
Couldn't spot the space between, could you, ever?
No, and there was bits where like they were exchanging near falls with cradles, and it was like 2.99. Not a single finisher kick out or head drop or any sort of sometimes abused and cheap tactic to generate a pop was necessary because they're so good at the timing and the when to do things and to when to put certain things in a match and how to build a match. Furious, blistering 12-minute TV match, except the selling was absolutely otherworldly. This is just absolutely fantastic professional wrestling. Perfect for the medium, for the slot, for the story. It was just unbelievable. Like CM Punk has spent 7 years away. Much of it, and I'm going to say this on Twitter because I will get likes, but the mega fans will forgive me. He spent 7 years away in reality doing horror movies, UFC fights, the training to do UFC fights, mm-hmm. writing comic books.
Attempting to get in the podcast game, but it's not cut out for everyone.
And when he's not doing those things, he's been not watching or investing in professional wrestling. Mm. He's operating at a level with the minutiae of his craft and how great he is at it, as if he spent those 7 years doing nothing but trying to perfect the art of doing it. Yes. Like, that's how good he is.
Remember the conversations? Like, this is going to sound overly critical, Punk, and I don't mean it to. But remember the conversations when he'd been gone long enough that, and this would happen to a lot of people, this is not on Punk, that it sort of felt like wrestling had passed him by. The style that CM Punk...
I honestly thought he was a bit overrated at one point.
There was him and Brian having these matches in WWE, which were obviously a level above what most of WWE could present because they were a level above. But then WWE itself, like through NXT and through everything else, sort of propelled itself into the next decade of professional wrestling. Mm. It sort of felt like CM Punk was very much of the prior one. He hasn't compromised that and yet feels like he belongs more to this than he did WWE. It's this the strangest thing that he's managed to capture. Nobody expects CM Punk to go out there and work a Kenny Omega, Bryan Danielson style thing, but his matches are all the better for it. He is providing his version of great wrestling to the... This is AEW's buffet at its best.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
Because the things that you can be critical about the buffet, the bad faith actors and the people that don't like wacky stuff or whatever, that's when you can be like, oh, but yeah, does it really need to be a buffet? Can it just be a wrestling show? This is the buffet.
He wouldn't have
Michelin star quality food and all you can eat.
He wouldn't have worked in old NXT, for example, I don't think.
No, I don't like... maybe he would have. I love these matches so much. I think they'd be so welcome. They'd have been welcome on
maybe,
one of the worst excess takeovers. They'd have been very, very welcome. But... yeah, he seems to fit, having not tried to speed up or like look at a PWG thing and think, right, I need to do more of that. I don't get that from Punk at all. And it would be completely understandable if you'd have thought, what if he's had a bit of FOMO? What if he's got a bit of panic or a bit of ego or vanity? And we know he's fueled by ego, you know, at some points in his career. I don't know how he's... It's dark arts, wrestling wizardry. I don't know how he's doing it, but I love watching him do it.
He's a genius. He's a professional wrestling genius. To take that out on Twitter, and again, the Mega fans will forgive me if they remember this one, is that it's as if he's wrestling with every technical sensibility that he had in Ring of Honor, and he's just stepped out of Ring of Honor and learned how to work a perfect TV match.
Mm.
It's like the WWE thing almost hasn't happened. It's bizarre, but it's incredible.
So Jericho Appreciation Society are backstage. We see a photo of Johnny Hungy hanging out with Chris Jericho when he was just a wee boy. And Jericho says, oh, it's a big moment for you, but you're just not on my level. Garcia cuts a promo and says tonight we'll give you an example of why a wrestler is going to get their ass handed to them by a sports entertainer. Jericho says he's going to future endeavor at Silver and Reynolds. Just like they did to Santana and Ortiz. There is a wonderful moment with, I'll give them their names, Daddy Magic and Cool Hand Ange, where they check behind the curtains to see if they're going to be attacked by Kingston, Santana and Ortiz. And Jericho says that are nowhere to be found. And we're the reason for that, basically. They're never coming back. And that's entertainment.
This is great. We were putting over, because when Mark's, you talk about this before we press record, the curtain bit. When they were peeking through the curtains, where are they? Well, in like 1 or 2 weeks' time, you're going to see Eddie Kingston's face behind the curtain and he's going to headbutt him and it's going to be tremendous.
There are many talents that obviously WWE shouldn't have released for a variety of reasons, but I hear myself saying this all the time on podcasts. You are measured in WWE by how well you can elevate bad material. They're doing bad material on purpose and making it fun. The curtain stuff is bad material. But in WWE, that would just be actually bad material, and Ever-Rise, as they once were there to elevate that. They might be two of the stupidest drops off Nick Khan's spreadsheet ever, more so than some of the great wrestlers that we all mourn the loss of their matches, because those two could have polished absolutely any turd that WWE had given them. Now they're doing it knowingly, and it's even better as a result. I love Daddy Magic and Cool Hand Ange so, so much. I think even more than I did when they were just this shining light in a dank, dark CWC. Seeing them, I feel a bit like Jerry. I feel like a proud dad. Like that, or Kevin Owens or something. There's something wonderful. Matt Menard's eyes are how he escalates his fury over nothing and then calms himself down again and then goes again. I don't know how he does the things he does with his face.
He's got that Taz Frank Costanza thing where his default mode is just like aggressive, like right yes. in your face and like so quick and prone with temper fit. It's just awesome.
whilst looking resplendent in white.
Oh, great, man. He's such a great shape as well, isn't
yeah.
he?
There's two more things on the J8S. One, they're not going too hard on the meta. It works within both universes. It works as parody and as an act in itself. It's not too cute and it's not too niche and too irreverent. So that's great. They are very carefully measuring out the little sports entertainment things without it being too much like pastiche. And another thing that I really like is that Jericho does not want to give up Judas, right? He doesn't want to go full heel. He loves Judas too much. It's fair. I would like it to. But they have baked a cake, iced it, and they're eating it at present.
With I mean, Jericho's not looking at him.
Yeah, I know. But Daddy Magic is continually doing the Judas thing, like, no, we will take it away from you if you don't appreciate Chris Jericho. So they kind of have the cake and eating it too.
Measure is the word, you know. Like, I keep comparing me in a circle, right? Jake Hager was an idiot, a dangerous, big, and violent idiot, but an idiot nonetheless. The Inner Circle were not idiots. The Inner Circle were a big deal, and you were to fear them and be concerned about them. These are idiots. Like, Daniel Garcia is not an idiot, and he's biding his time, and this is absolutely an opportunity for him. The rest of them are complete idiots, in different scales of idiocy, but idiots nonetheless. And I think that's such an important distinction between these and the Inner Circle for where they are and where they're, like,
exactly
what they're there to do in this company.
We previewed the Tornado Tag as wild, and we were quite correct in our prediction. It was the Hardys, Darby Allin and Sting versus Private Party, the Butcher and the Blade, and the record continues with the Blade on Dynamite, of course. I apologise, I'm probably going to miss some of the bonkers spots, just like the cameras did, which I felt genuinely sorry for them. Normally we sat there and go, Christ's sake, you know, whether it be in WWE or AEW, how do you not know to cut for this spot or whatever? But it was just like, oh, bollocks, something's happening over here, and there, and Jeff. And it's like the worst combination of people, in the best possible way, I mean. But like, because like Darby Allin's not going to go, okay, and we set ourselves, and then we go for the bonkers, you know, human lawn dart through the ropes. Jeff Hardy's just going to be like, okay, and we wait, and then we throw ourselves like a crash test dummy at this guy who's just leaning on the barricade or whatever. It was just mad. So if I miss something, I do apologize. I mean, we started off with a missile tope from Darby as Private Party and the Butcher and the Blade are making their entrance, and Sting does a top rope dive onto all of them. Your ass pounded by a 63-year-old is never looked more impressive. And then again, it just flits over, Blade's against the barricade, and Jeff just throws himself at him. Sting hits a Stinger Splash on, I think, Isaiah Cassidy on the outside. There's a great photo doing the rounds on Twitter of him mid-flight, I think, for that one. Darby and Butcher brawl up into the stands, continuing what happened on Rampage. And there's Andrade El Idolo to whip Darby with his belt, and then Butcher does that thing where he swings Darby around, bouncing him off like the concrete walls and the glass barriers, basically, and then just power bombs him down some stairs because Darby Allin's bonkers. Matt sets Isaiah Cassidy up for a side effect off the stage, but then Quinn's there and he low blows him, and they hit a double team side effect off the stage through a table. And we cut to the concourse. Jeff Hardy and Sting are there. They're fighting with Butcher and Blade, and Darby shows up and they set him up on these, they're selling t-shirts, I think, on the tables there. Jeff Hardy not only climbs up a ladder, but then just climbs up a bit of the wall, basically. There's a, not a deliberate thing, but there's a platform, like a girder built into the wall that Jeff Hardy just sort of shimmers along. And then, Swanton bombs both Butcher and Blade through the tables. I have no idea what happened here. I assume Jeff Hardy setting up and Sting was like, you got this, Jeff? Sweet. Sprints back down to ringside. He comes back down to the ring, and then he's fighting off Private Party. He's checking on Matt Hardy, who's been dragged to the ring by Private Party. Isaiah Cassidy hits him with a chair, and Sting no-sells it and fires up, fights off both members of Private Party, who go for the gin and juice thing of theirs, but Sting counters it into a scorpion death drop, and he hits that as Matt Hardy hits a twist of fate. 1, 2, 3. The mad old lads win, basically.
I'm going to be the boring guy first before I get into a better mood. Give Sting 2 months off at this point, because the finish was a little bit deflating. Let's be honest about this. It was a little bit like you were in this rush of ridiculous chaos and energy and fun. Like, fun is the absolute word for this. And then it was like, oh, the spell's being broken here, because that was one ambitious spot too far. And I don't know if it's because he's been like hammering it for the past however many months, from Holiday Bash and then the Acclaimed and then Revolution. 2 months. 2 months because that was an ambitious spot too far. Everything else in this match was incredible. Like, I'm going to use a comparison for two purposes here. One, well, the comparison itself first. Triple H, X-Pac, and the Radicals.
Mm-hmm.
Not Eddie Guerrero because he'd been injured.
Yep.
Versus Rock and Sock Connection and Too Cool.
Dallas Raw.
The Dallas Raw.
Yep.
Known, before AEW came along, that possibly would have been remembered forevermore as one of the all-time great television matches. All those all-time great television matches just aren't really that great anymore. Like, sorry. Like, AEW has done far too many fantastic ones that it just feels like they wouldn't belong in any top 10 lists anymore. I would have 10 AEW ones. And it's because of reasons like this. This was not even the best match on the show. And it's still kind of better than a lot of WWE TV matches that have been held in the highest regard for so many years. What I loved about that match, and I still love it, is there's a spot, right? And it's similar to the production problems, air quotes, that weren't problems, that were just features, not bugs. There's a spot in that 10-man Dallas Tag Raw, which is legendary, where The Rock reverses a Triple H suplex on the old vertical ramp, and he suplexes Triple H on the ramp, and you can hear the thud before Triple H hits the ramp, and that's because, as couldn't possibly be captured by the camera at the same time, someone's just swung a chair in someone's head. The match is better for how much is missed,
yeah,
because of how chaotic and overspilling it is, and that was exactly the same kind of vibe here. The Butcher, there was a moment where The Butcher started swinging Darby Allin about and threw him down some stairs, having followed the first match, which is a wonderful contrast and compliment to this one, where I thought this could be the best Dynamite of all time, because it was just so much goddamn fun, but it wasn't frivolous.
Mm.
It was a real genuine violent danger. The AHFO storyline ultimately has ruled. It has to have ruled.
We've had two incredible brawls that almost, like, I can't think of a better example of the ends justifying the means more than this one in the last 5 years.
And we're getting Andrade Derby.
That will also rule.
That'd be incredible.
The Butcher and Darby Allin is the most unexpected legacy feud in AEW, maybe ever, and I just want more of it.
Dynamite next week, the Andrade match.
The Andrade match is next week, yeah. The Butcher, like, now, you're going to salivate every time there's even the possibility of the Butcher getting his hands on Darby Allin. If there's ever going to be a tag graphic or a trios graphic or whatever, because I'm like, it's them two. Great. Like, they've established that off the back of all of this. Yeah, like, not a lot to add. Like, this, all of these images that we saw kind of spoke for themselves. You know, it wasn't about, this wasn't about psychology, nor should it have been. This was an attritional war between the two groups. More than the, obviously it's a cool visual seeing it happen outside, like, of the traditional area, so you get this strange window ledge that Jeff jumped off and just looks good, the colours and all that, it just looks and feels different. But Jeff does that with this kind of, it's the ordinary to a psychopath like Jeff Hardy. I loved the way he splatted into the blade to clothesline him over the barricade. That looked less Jeff Hardy than the Swanton.
Mm.
I have seen, like, I love it, of course, look at him putting his life on the line for us, but I've seen it a million times. I don't think I've seen him throw himself into somebody like he did the blade like that in forever. That was a guy that had, I believed, in the moment, the energy for a big old fight, not Jeff Hardy coming to work to do Jeff Hardy things.
Mm.
And I think that was the difference quite a few times over the course of both of these completely absorbing matches that make up for a storyline that was only half-baked, and there's still one more to come.
Dax and Cash are backstage talking about Gun Club, talking about wrestling from the heart. Reference the Ass Boys thing, but they don't really want to go too much into that. Talks about them respect being grandfathered in, they're puppies, blah blah blah. They're not spoiled brats, but you know these people trying to take their spot anyway. Regardless, Dax and Cash say they are the best tag team Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and they're going to see them next week on Dynamite.
I adored this promo. You know, I don't just want to talk about people who FTR like, in which case Bret Hart, more pink lighting, more heart, all this sort of stuff. I want to talk about people they don't like. Shawn Michaels, again. Did you see the way in which, I think it was Dax, might have been Cash, no, I'm pretty sure it was Dax, the way in which he had no choice but to offer the most begrudging of respect to Billy Gunn, because what has he just spoken about recently? That infamous Raw 25 moment, that thing with Shawn Michaels and all their mates, and they're the real Ass Boys, DX the Ass Boys, not Billy Gunn's kids. Like, he had to endure that, and there's that ever slight, like, little bit of resentment. He's like, it's Billy Gunn. Like, yes, he's a legend, inverted commas. I do respect him a bit because he's paved the way, but I don't respect what he is or what he represents, and I certainly don't respect his kids. And I love, like, the little internal battle he had of whether or not to decide in that moment while talking down the lens at the Ass Boys whether or not to show respect and reverence to the dad, because he was in that ring on that night. when everything like hit the wall like never before for them too, and what that all represents. I love babyface turns that happen through wrestling. Like, I love this FTR babyface turn. Love it. They are wrestling matches, and they are just, they're not cheating. That's all they've done is stop cheating. Like, Dax coming out and giving it to his partner in the middle of the match, like babyface stuff, and then Punk getting riled up by it as well. Like, where the camera shot Punk's face as it was happening, thinking, not for me. Like, this is a babyface thing, isn't it? I love seeing people turn babyface through the act and the art of wrestling. It's magic. This turn, and obviously MJF kind of alludes to it later on, this whatever's next for FTR, I'm just gripped by it.
Yeah, I'm absolutely on the hook. Absolutely on the hook. Dax Harwood is better for his flubs. He feels like a real human being feeling everything he says. And it's just so much better. Yet again, the polished anodyne, searingly fake WWE scripted promo. They do this in WWE to try and avoid what Dax Harwood was doing. Mm. Why would you avoid that? That's real emotion. That's what people get into. They are a stupid company.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Then we got Michael Sidgwick's most anticipated match on this show, I think. The Varsity Blondes, not the Hollywood Blondes, versus Bryan Danielson and Jon Moxley, featuring Grumpy Julia Hart sat on the steps with an eye patch on. So Regal's there on commentary.
She's shy.
And Moxley and Danielson just get set on him the moment the bell rings, beat them both down. Pillman gets out of there, tags in Garrison, and he just gets wrecked by a German suplex immediately by Moxley. They dominate through the break. When we come back, release German suplex, a pile driver on Pillman. That all gets a near fall. Garrison, though, comes in. He fires up, chins him, and they hit that sort of... It's not a heart attack. It's like a drop kick slam thing of theirs. The double team, basically. That gets them an earful, but that's enough for them. Danielson cuts that off with his Busaiku knee. Moxley hits the paradigm shift. Again, as we've seen previously in Danielson matches, match is won. The match is over, guys. But no, they cave their heads in, and then simultaneous submissions get the victory for them. Post-match, Moxley gets a mic and said, the only man whose opinion he cared about was William Regal's, and he's earned this opportunity through blood, sweat, pain, and torture, just like Danielson. They'd gone through hell together to form this team. This message was for anyone who thinks that they've got what it takes to stand beside them. They aren't giving out any free passes. You need to reach down deep into your soul and find that place where you find pain. They are the Blackpool Combat Club. And the only way, Michael Sidgwick, is the hard way.
Yes, it's absolutely awesome. My one tiny quibble about this entire thing, which from start to finish has just been absolutely exceptional, is that I thought Moxley in particular had been somewhat marginalized or reduced by all of this, considering he's the world champion. He's the guy who didn't get the same sort of effusive praise.
Ringing endorsement
as Danielson did. Don't like Jon Moxley getting slapped to no reply. My only issue with all of this has been, Jon Moxley doesn't feel like the Jon Moxley of 2020. And I adored that man, as we all did. And then he gets the mic. They know what they're doing. Let it play out. You dumb, specky, weak-chinned because if you just fucking keep watching, all your problems will eventually get solved. My one problem with this entire near-perfect thing has just become perfect. Match itself, Brian Pillman Jr. got lit up in the corner by Bryan Danielson, and it was awesome. It was absolutely awesome. But the best bit of violence in the entire match, again, Moxley was a little bit, he's wonderful at professional wrestling. He's a different professional wrestler than Bryan Danielson. He's kind of in there with Bryan Danielson, whose stuff looks a bit better, to be honest. And then he just rocks Griff Garrison with a forearm, where it's like, how have you not broken that poor bastard's jaw? It was awesome. So the best violence was administered by Moxley here and not Danielson. And he got the promo time. The Julia Hart stuff. Look, there's no goo yet. No. So it's fine. But it's a bit Alexa Bliss, and I hate Alexa Bliss. So let's be consistent there. I'm not that into it at all, if I'm being perfectly honest.
Why is she still not in the House of Blick? Like, it's been there from week one, and they've still persisted with this as if anybody really gives a... Just put her in the group.
Penna got changed pretty quickly.
Want to like compliment Moxley and Danielson here, because like I don't have anything to add to how glorious it was watching the grisly violence enacted on the blondes, but this is the difference. They're so good at this. Compare this to last week when their job was not actually to put themselves over, but to go out and get a wheelie eater over, versus this week when it was absolutely their job to get themselves back over, because this was the week the name was officially going to be announced. Moxley was kind of going to flesh out that last little detail of the story of why he was as invested in this project as Brian. This wasn't about a wheelie uter or even, bless him, a Griff Garrison getting any shine. Mm. This was about them being them this week. And I love that they're such pros that they can switch that on and off as and when they need to, because that's going to really help when they're welcoming other people into the group. And like, Cesaro still feels like a ghost of this whole thing, just like waiting to reveal himself too, which is no bad thing, you know, like the, whether or not that's as a turn on Moxley because Regal kind of favours him, or whether he becomes the next person to add to this long term. I'm not advocating push Cesaro, but I kind of am, because he is a perfect fit for this.
Mm, absolutely. Then it was time for the star of the show, MJF, to come out. He's flanked by Sean Spears, of course. There's security standing around ringside just in case that ungrateful bastard decides to show up. And he talks about Wardlow, saying, oh, what a shame it was you couldn't win the TNT Championship last week. You know, I really was going to let you keep that title, but unfortunately, you weren't good enough to beat Scorpio Sky. Just when I thought, oh, yeah, okay, we're just going to bury Wardlow in this promo, fine. He just drops a little nugget in about CM Punk. Says, clearly you had to cheat to win. I've already beaten you twice. I had the next match won, but you had to cheat to win. And we will cross paths again at some point. But even then, it won't be over until I attend your funeral and piss on your grave. Magic.
He said, I promise you, I'll give you the most embarrassing defeat of your life. They've just booked something.
Yeah.
That's what's so amazing about all this. They've just booked something there. That's, pick what you want. Punk wins the title, and then MJF takes it off him in 3 minutes in his first defense. Something. That matters, that line. And that's as an addendum to one of the best pieces of business in the last 20 years. I couldn't believe that he said that. Like, that was incredible.
There's a bit of me, right? You ever have that thing where something's so good, you're like, never go back to it. Because it's my favorite feud in AEW's history. I've said this. So I'm like... And I can defend it now. There's nothing. I don't think there's anything that someone could. It could say, you can say Kenny Omega, Hangman Page. I think it's horses for courses at that point. But it's got such a nice bow on the top of it. And then they tease that, and I go, yeah, reopen it up. Actually, yeah, just keep doing it. Keep doing it forever because I love it. And
it's a specific promise.
But it's also
and there's a nervousness and cruelty to that I'm worried for the day that Punk has to face those consequences.
And again, like you always say, because. AEW, I've got faith and trust in them. I'm not thinking they're going to turn around next week and go, CM Punk was from MJF. But like, I have faith that that's not just a throwaway line. Yeah. Like, they might have something on the docket for 2 years bloody time for this. But we like, when they say that, it's not just we'll bloody face off in a Money in the Bank match in 6 months or something like that. So anyway, back to Wardlow. He gets called Pig by MJF. There's a Wardlow chant, of course. He says, look, if it wasn't for me, no one would know who you are. And you repaid me by costing me the most important match of my life. And then you had the audacity to ask for me to release you from your contract. But unfortunately, you signed a deal with the devil. And I'm going to make your life a living hell. Which gets, I think, a Jesus chant from the crowd. To which MJF magnificently responds that he's going to nail Wardlow to a cross just like Jesus.
Well, they're not being funny. If they're going to say something that could be interpreted as somewhat anti-Semitic to him.
Yeah.
Just
So they chanted Jesus because he called himself the devil, isn't it? It's the idea that like whatever he is, they just want to be represent the opposite of.
And it's Texas, of course.
It is Texas, yeah.
Jesus, 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 Jesus.
And the crowd full of Zandigs. Jesus, Jesus.
He says basically that he owns Wardlow, and if he deems fit to kick that, quote, skank mother of Wardlow's out of her house, then he's going to have to listen to him. Understandably, all this brings out Wardlow, who starts fighting the security, but there's too many. There's like 10, 12 of them by around him at that point. And they don't beat him up. They just restrain him so he can listen to what Maxwell's got to say. And he reminds Wardlow he doesn't work for AEW. He works for MJF. And that means right now, right here, he's trespassing. And MJF is just going to keep paying Wardlow week after week, month after month, year after year to stay at home until people forget that he exists. And Wardlow gets sent away. He doesn't get dragged off. He's like, I'll figure out a way to get my hands on this git eventually, basically. But he's not going to try and beat up 12 security guys. But MJF, as you alluded to earlier, Hamflet, says the Pinnacle aren't over. And starting next week with the FTR, Pinnacle are going to move up in the world. And Spears closes it out by saying, when you're in the Pinnacle, you're always on top.
This is absolutely incredible, as expected. Not only did it drive the storyline forward, it creates the mystery of how Wardlow's not only going to wrestle MJF at some point, but even come back. Great, the next block of episodic television is absolutely sorted out. The content of the promo was vile in the best possible way. Continue to heckle MJF every single week because he will come up with an improvised comeback as fabulous as he just did. And they did one of the best versions I can recall of what I will describe as the thing wrestling has to do, but it's often a bit clumsy. And that is, you have to put over your opponent, but you have to bury them so you have to make them seem like they're worth beating, and you have to personally insult them so it feels like the conflict is organic. Sometimes, even though it's necessary in the way to do it, it's a bit clumsy and a bit daft.
Yes.
Like, you're an absolute arsehole, I'm going to kill you, and I hate you more than anyone, but you've got really good muscles, and you're really strong. Like, you have to compliment them at the same time, so it's a bit, it's just a wrestling thing. He didn't articulate any of Wardlow's qualities. He buried him for being a poor nobody who's going to go back to destitution and obscurity. But he had a huge security detail in front of the ring because that was the visual cue of, genuinely, I'm scared of you. And this is the visual way to convey that without doing a bit of clumsy sort of wordplay. All of this is fantastic.
Yeah, he said something like, you're only all that you are because of me. So the implicated... So he is all something then.
Yeah.
Like he's just
yeah.
like kind of peppered that in there a little bit without, as you say, like saying, oh, you got big muscles. Is Wardlow going to sign for Ring of Honor?
Ooh.
Like at Supercard of Honor. Tony Khan said he's going to have his hands all over Supercard of Honor. I know it's going to go head to head with Rampage or something, which is weird. But, you know, we know how he, like, is this a possible? It was my first thought was when they were laboring hard. And I'm glad they are, by the way, because I think that's the most interesting detail of this. And I'm glad it wasn't. I was worried when he cost against Scorpio Sky that they were going to kind of pull away from that a little bit. Wardlow works for him, and he absolutely doesn't work. Like, the last thing now, what we're going to be pining for is a Wardlow is all elite graphic, which is quite remarkable, really, considering that he's been with the company 2 years. When you're going to get that graphic drop, it's going to be awesome. Mm. But in the meantime, could he, as CM Punk once did, because he signed a contract in the middle of a Ring of Honor ring.
But he's under contract to MJF.
Mm. That's true, yeah.
This is almost as good as the John Cena is contracted to the Nexus storyline. It's getting there for me. Right, backstage.
Always these MJF segments where he ruins it. MJF is typically involved in some like the elite tier stuff of all elite wrestling, and he does this.
He's the wanker.
Right, the best friends are backstage. But before Wheeler Yuta can basically say anything, Trent stops him and you know, he's referencing what happened, obviously, with the Blackpool Combat Club,
yeah.
Of course.
God, it's so awesome.
It's great, isn't it?
But Trent stops him.
For our American listeners that are like, don't know Blackpool or like assume England to be like merry old England and all that sort of stuff.
It's the Las Vegas of England.
Like, no offense to listeners, I've been to Blackpool a lot. Like, rough as arseholes, Blackpool.
Oh,
and
my
I like rough English towns. I'm from a rough northern English town. Blackpool is a rough northern English town. I would not want to go to a combat club in Blackpool.
I'm from a rough English town, Bygate said. So I'm also allowed to say I've never been to Blackpool, but everything I've ever read about it, it's like,
it's magic, man. Well,
like, my parents used to take me to Blackpool in around the time that the Illuminations were. So, yeah. You know, autumn, winter time, basically. And all I remember is, on the one hand, like you say, just being a wide-eyed child. Oh, my God, look, there's trams going around, and I'm having ice cream, and I'm going in arcades and all the lights. And also my dad being like, don't step too far away from me. Don't know what's going to be around these corners, basically. So, yeah, perfect.
Billy Regal, gonna chin young Adam Wilborn. Give your eye good bloody thrashing.
I'm going to teach you a trade, son. Come here.
Stretch you out. Trent stops him, though. He says, I never liked you, Wheeler. These guys have trained you. He's talking about Cassidy and Chuck, of course, and let you stay with them, let you crash on their couch. And now you just, what? You just got your head turned by this other group or whatever. I'm done with you. And Wheeler says, look, I love Orange and Trent, but... I love Orange and Chuck. Never really liked you, though, either. I'm not trying to be the best friend I can be. I'm trying to be the best wrestler.
I like how, like, Trent's actual kind of dickhead edge is now canon in storylines. And it just works so beautifully because he's always had it in him to be like, he's one of these lowercase Twitter guys.
Mm-hmm.
He's a bit too cool for school as it is, Trent. And it's canon now. He's legitimately got this edge about him.
Mm.
And they are acknowledging that.
It's a total gem, this as well, isn't it? Like last week, the whole thing was, why would we stay with the best friends if this is even remotely on the table? And they fleshed out this idea that Trent would be a bit resentful because Uter effectively replaced him, didn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Like, the best friends brought Wheeler Uter in without really getting Trent's say-so because he was on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
So their hostilities are completely organic, and the best friends can sort of feel a little bit sad. They can look at it as, Trent, why are you being an arsehole? All you're doing is pushing him further away. So you kind of believe all the reasons for everybody doing everything. And yeah, Utah wanting to be kind of surpassing all of this and beyond this is great as well because it just puts over the Blackpool Combat Club.
Mm. Just hope they don't get cursed. Then as a favour.
The day that Danielson headbutts Danhausen in the face.
I can't wait.
It's going to be absolutely
splattered
incredible.
All over that white makeup.
I still keep thinking that time that Moxley was just charging towards him before he got dove onto. He just kept walking. I was like, kill him, kill him.
Jay Lethal, Adam Cole was next. Back and forth early on. Lethal hits the lethal combination, but Cole gets out of the way of the step-up dropkick, and he's doing the... boom on the apron to taunt, basically, and just gets kicked at that point. Numerous suicide dives from Jay Lethal, and this brings out Red Dragon on the ramp and taking us into break. Cole takes control. When we come back, Lethal goes to the figure four, but he gets countered into a pin. Happens a few times, actually, and then on the, third attempt, Lethal manages to get it locked on. Cole manages to get to the ropes and Red Dragon causes a distraction to allow Cole to roll Lethal up for a two count. But as Cole goes for the boom, Lethal counters nicely into a cutter. Cole reverses the lethal injection with a super kick. Nice visual that. Hits a Panama Sunrise as Lethal's just on Bambi on ice, I think is the best way of describing it. That gets a two count as well. But this time again, Lethal dodges out of the way of the lowering of the boom, rolls Cole up, but this causes Red Dragon to distract the official. And as this time, Jay Lethal goes for the lethal injection, Cole goes for his special move, punch him in the bollocks, does that, lowers the boom, 1, 2, 3. Let's talk the match, and then we'll talk about what happened afterwards, Hamlet.
So the match was good, never great, and a couple of times it... got a little bit too safe, I think, with the high spots. The fans were mad into it by the end, but they were kind of worked into that by wanting to see the big hits rather than anything. That there was no like great psychological flow to this in contrast to the first one. There was just bigger moments that the fans are kind of at this point, and I don't say the fans as if I don't exclude myself in this, if I was in that crowd, you kind of trained to pop for and you want to see it live and you want to see the action. That's maybe a little bit of a criticism more of Adam Cole at large, because it could have been with anyone in there. Like Jay Lethal can obviously base himself for these things, but a lot of people could have been there. Sort of leads to my big problem with this match, and I do have to sort of fold in what happened after the fact. I think, like, this was too much wrestling for wrestling's sake, and I think they got the booking wrong here. If all of this existed solely for the post-match segment, which it did,
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, we're going to have another Adam Cole, Hangman Page thing. We're going to have a face-off between them. Book Hangman Page to win a match instead of Adam Cole.
He does feel like an afterthought occasionally.
I've said this a couple of weeks ago. I would much rather, as a world champion, if he's not going to always feel like the primary concern of the show, which he never really has done, just have him be like the great wrestler that wins all the time. And
exactly.
Have him do that.
You're doing it too similar to what they did with Omega, but that was very different because it was bloody Kenny Omega, basically, i.e. him not wrestling as much.
It all just felt backdrop to the post-match. So if you're going to have a match that is backdrop, give it to Page and have him just either defend his title like he did. Ah, sod it. Yeah, I'll get your title match. Or just by showing himself to be the champion. Because ultimately, you're just going to get Tim and Cole having a bit of a back and forth.
The idea, though, is that Cole needed a singles win over an established star.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
And Jay Lethal has been sort of, I don't particularly like the guy, but he's been positioned as a guy who it's maybe 2 or 3 years too late for him to be an ace figure, but he's genuinely great at the craft and very tenured and accomplished and all the rest of it. So I understand what they're doing with Lethal in the role that he's in. This, for me, there were certain moments in this match which was shallow but really exciting, and I was into it by the end. There were certain sequences where, you know, I've been trumpeting the benefits of this buffet. Like, homogenized sports entertainment sucks. I've hated it for years and years and years. I love the idea of a buffet. In fact, it's so successful that AEW, with its angles, promos, stylistic range, and how diverse it is, it's like a hub for wrestling and all the best bits of it that I can't really get into other promotions at this point. I just can't. Everything I want is in there. So I'm a huge proponent of the buffet, but there were certain times when they were going through these sort of counter-driven sequences where they were very obviously kind of cooperating with each other to arrive at big spots, where I thought they were damned by the comparison to Dax versus Punk in terms of what an effective worked struggle they did in that opener, to the point where it kind of exposed this style on the same night in such quick succession as more choreographed than it would ordinarily look.
And the shock face kick out. And
so he needs to stop doing that. I think one of the reasons that Adam Cole, that I think is, there's an off quality to Adam Cole. I don't think there's a single person in good faith who said this Adam Cole run is an unqualified, amazing success. I think everyone, to varying degrees, has said, oh, there's something not quite amazing, five star about all of this. And I keep trying to articulate what it is. I don't know what it is. I don't know if there's too many stars at this point, where a star of his wattage just doesn't feel like as big as he could be with a more disciplined sized roster. I don't know if, because he was booked really well in WWE. He didn't need to reinvent himself. He didn't need to prove, like a Miro or a Moxley, that he could be so much better than he was. He's kind of just made a lateral move. And when the other moves have felt like such a sobering indictment of the WWE system, that it just, it doesn't feel as dramatically different or brilliant with Adam Cole. It just feels like he's made a lateral move, playing kind of the same role, doing kind of the same matches, kind of the same tropes, and it just doesn't feel like this huge reckoning of a broken WWE system. And maybe that's got something to do with it. I really don't know.
He certainly inherited one problem from WWE. I want to cheer him. I'm ready for babyface Adam Cole in AEW way sooner than I thought I would be. I know there's a bigger story that they're, I'm assuming at least they're still telling with Omega and the books and things like that. But I'm watching him, and especially because I don't feel like he's remotely a threat to Hangman Page, he already feels like he's outstayed his welcome as a heel. And we were kind of already there in NXT. We were desperate to have him as a babyface, and WWE just refused to do it. I already think we're at that point. It's taken less than a year, and I already feel like we're there in AEW. He's like, I know you've got the big match, and God knows when Kenny's going to be back, but like, lean in as soon as possible. Because like, Cole's pretty much spent force as a heel.
He cut a promo afterwards.
He's so over. We can't not say that.
Oh, yeah.
He is so over. He got...
It'd be one of your favourite things of going to an AEW show. He still would be.
He's incredibly over. His catchphrase, it's not just that, but like, he gets one of the biggest pops. His call and responses, it's thunderous. Even in the matches, and bear in mind, he had a main event AEW pay-per-view match, which is so difficult to make loud. He made loud. He's an absolute megastar, and yet he could still be even better.
He's a Randy Orton, but the work's good.
Yeah,
he's that pro wrestler type figure, but it's way more
eternally over. Yeah. Eternally over.
He grabbed a mic, said nobody deserved the AEW World Championship more than him. Said Hangman Page was scared of him. He knows that he's the one who's going to take the title off him. He's trying to bait him out, and it works. Basically, out comes Hangman Page to a massive numbers disadvantage, but he doesn't care. He whips all three of them with his belt. But then Cole, again, special move, hits his low blow and they beat him down. Who should make the save but Jungle Boy and Luchasaurus and Christian Cage, I should say. But Adam Cole steals the world title and leaves.
It's a thing.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of people stealing world titles.
I, case by case with belt theft, sometimes it's really, really entertaining. It's always dependent on the principal characters involved. I would like a belt theft angle substantially more if I didn't feel a belt was horribly, horribly disrespected.
Oh, we're just about to get to that.
About a segment later. Like, disastrous in terms of like how you've agented and laid this out.
I suppose they could give Hangman Page an interim title for the time being. Lance Archer, Dustin Rhodes, nice promo package for Rampage, which we will, of course, preview on the Rampage preview tomorrow, because I have to get... Oh, to Sammy Guevara and Tay Conti. They are in the ring, cutting a promo and being asked about, you know, the state of affairs considering what's happened to them in recent weeks. And Guevara says, like, I haven't got the TNT Championship anymore, or the other one, but he does have this ring. He is always going to put on a great show. You know, all he really wants is the fans' appreciation. He knows about people saying, you're going to kill yourself, or you're going to take years off. You can't keep taking these bumps, but he doesn't give a damn. Conti cuts a promo in Portuguese, I'm going to say, but then translates for herself and says she just wants payback, and she was going to kick Paige VanZant's ass just like she got during her entire MMA career. This brings out American top team, Dan Lambert, Scorpio Sky and Ethan Page, who's great to hear, by the way, has signed a new contract with AEW. And Lambert introduces them all, Ethan Page, not as the tightest tits in the game, but as one of the only things that Canada's gotten right in a long old time, basically. He says he is the most popular co-TNT champion of all time. And then you've also got Paige VanZant, the biggest signing in AEW history, but also as part of her contract, she said she wouldn't appear in stained towns like Austin, Texas, which obviously gets a reaction. And you can go and check her out on her Patreon, I think it was, $9.99. I mean, she's the reason why Orange Cassidy keeps his hands in his pockets all day, basically. What's that implying?
To conceal his hard cack.
Oh, thank you. Because he's got
to play with his hard cack.
And then he brings up Scorpio Sky, TNT champion, a man who hasn't lost a match since Tony Khan reached puberty. And then he turns his attentions to the guys in the ring, Tiny Tim and his girlfriend, Lucha Horus. He says, look, they've got no interest in...
she's in a monogamous committed relationship, and she's a woman.
But he says they got no interest in any matches, any rematches or anything. And if they ever want to get their hands on the team...
Being sexually promiscuous is fine. Yep. Just in case I feel like that was not made obvious by the last thing I said.
Yes. And he says, if you want, you know, the TNT Championship match, you can kiss it goodbye. And he takes off the interim TNT Championship and he plants a smacker on it. And they say the wrong thing. I'm not even...
Say the line, Wilbur.
It's not even the thing that they said that everyone's gone mental about. You can't be a babyface and use the phrase rent-free, because that's what all dickheads on the internet say. But that's what they say anyway. They say they've been living rent-free.
Is a dickhead on the internet. Sammy Guevara is a dickhead on the internet.
Yeah. They say they've been living rent-free in Dan Lambert's head. But if only he knew what they did, what he and Tay did whilst they were wearing that belt. They now live in Dan's mouth too.
Were you confused by this?
A little bit confused.
So you didn't know what they were getting at?
No.
I think it was like a combination of cum and pussy juice.
Pussy juice is such a 14-year-old boy thing to say, isn't it?
A little bit of pussy juice, I thought.
Pussy juice and dick splash.
I felt the color jeans.
As much as we are laughing about it, you guys weren't a fan of this.
I thought this was a complete disaster. Tonally, it was right there with Brandy and Cody versus Dan Lambert. So you've not done an upgrade or downgrade, you've done the same grade. You know, the segments where everybody was a complete arsehole? Have some more of it. Why? Why would you do this? Why would you have not heard this thing and then actually looked at the Cody and Brandy exit as a bit of a lucky escape and thought, ooh, probably got out of trouble there because people considered those two segments to be the worst in Dynamite history. And it's like, can we not forget that with anybody else in the roster? Have we got anybody else that might piss people off just as much? As Cedric often says, we talk about this in the office before we press record because we love this stuff, right? But I wanted to kind of, I don't know, double check with you guys that I wasn't coming across as certain other podcasters that say things to be heard rather than to say things analytically. Bad faith actors that do nearly as well as we do in the podcast charts, but I don't necessarily believe all the criticisms.
And you're top of the mountain, it's hard to see who's below you, but yeah, granted.
Who espouse...
Mount of omnipotence.
They espouse certain old values of the industry, tennis racket in hand, and they use that as the racket as the stick to beat AEW with when they did just the silly stuff in their own. used to love him. Wish I could still love him just earnestly. Anyway, I didn't want to be him by saying, like, where are we at with shagging on the belts? Where are we at with jizz on the belts? Because the belts are why everybody goes to work in wrestling. That's why they turn up for work. That's what this is all about. That's why Hangman Page is pissed off one segment ago that he's had it taken off him because he had to do like he had to fight through mental and physical health crises to win that belt from Kenny Omega. That's what all of this is for. That's why Kenny Omega was a belt collector. That's why John Moxley kept the train on the tracks for the whole world in 2020. Coming on a belt is a heel thing. And they're presenting this stupid bro-y corner of this company. Sex is cool. It's like, nothing makes you sound like more like a virgin.
Daniel Garcia, was it Daniel Garcia who tweeted them?
Was that why he stood like there?
He tweeted, oh, guys, have you had sex?
Yeah. Like, that's the sort of tragic irony of all of this is, like, nothing could be lamer than them thinking that, like, I'm being cool because of sex. I hated this. Sammy Guevara and Ty Conti have experienced some pretty awful times, I imagine, over the last 6 months through the people in social media that have no place with which to pass comment on their life. What they will do here is amplify that through the roles they're being asked to portray. And that's less than ideal as well. And we are yet again, this is a Sidgwick take, so I want to use this as a segue to you rather than just out and out steal it. How are they not finding babyfaces for Dan Lambert again? How is this heel should be perfect for anybody to get cheered for, and they are doing it wrong again.
And Eddie Kingston alludes to this on Twitter, but the TNT title is especially.
Yeah, it's got an absolute...
I didn't even consider that.
It's got a sacred reverence that you just shouldn't be doing any of this juvenile nonsense with. Yeah, this is absolutely abysmal, and there's just layers and layers and layers and layers upon layers of just terrible things about it. Sammy Guevara's cum, Dan Lambert being repulsed by, there's homophobic overtones to this, just on top of absolutely everything else. So it's, I personally find it disrespectful. I know a lot of people have a laugh at that on Twitter. I just don't like it at all. In terms of character and all the rest of it, again, like, you cannot possibly, unless you're incompetent, and this company really isn't, make Dan Lambert not the biggest heel. How do you turn Jim Cornette not a heel in AEW, which is absolutely ridiculous. All this is absolute nonsense. And Sammy Guevara and Ty Conti, like Tony Conti's to have a word. Instead, as Hamlet very accurately points out, they are probably, not that it's absolutely justified, but they are probably going to be subject to more abuse about their relationship. But that being said, they can have all the fun they want. They are absolutely free to broadcast all the fun that they're having. All the sexy, wet, slidey, friction fun with their hot bodies. All the full sex they're having. Missionary, doggy style, on top, all the positions.
All the positions. The real sex habits.
People are going to resent this. Mm. They are young, incredibly good-looking people having vigorous sex sessions. They've said that they posted a picture of when they got beat up last week, and she was on top of him. They were both KO'd on the ring. Tay Conti, like, went, that's us after the fourth round. So the idea is that they've had full vaginal, maybe even anal intercourse with a penile refractory period, of which the 30-something male could only be completely jealous, because that's long since gone, of the mid-20s.
Are they going to do that as well? Are they going to bounce these criticisms back? And they're like, sorry, you guys don't have enough sex like we do. Is that like, are we going to be seen as like prudish mugs for being critical of this broadly? Is that how they're going to reframe this possibly, as baby faces?
But like, who cares?
Yeah.
They are like Ric Flair in that space station studio, Jim Crockett goddamn promotions, right? Said, as a heel, the reason why you hate me, the reason why I'm one of the best heel acts ever, the reason why I've drawn more money than a lot of people in AEW ever have or ever will, is because you want to know that people are doing well, but you don't want to know that they're doing better than you. Sammy Guevara's entire character is, I'm better than everyone, guys. Brazilian babe, jizzing on the belt, maybe I face at the same time, 4 times in a day at a minimum.
Minimum.
I'm a champion. You know, get all the pops going crazy through table. It's a terrible baby face work.
Do you remember that Inner Circle segment that time where Sammy, like Jericho gave Sammy the mic and he said something and you could see Jericho like wasn't best impressing. He's like, kind of do it again. Like, hard elbow from like dad. So I'm like, do that, but do it better. I feel like he needs to go back to do all that, do it better.
Yeah.
All that from this, just do it better.
Right, should we move on?
Yes, please.
Sammy, you finished? Okay, thanks.
No, the penile refractory period. Nothing to Sammy Guevara. I've got a...
it wasn't even his cock.
Video promo for Ricky Starks versus Swerve Strickland for the FDW Championship.
Coolest match of all time, but yeah. I'm not going to talk about it.
No, we're going to get too excited.
We'll Swerve's another Rampage exclusive. They figured out Ultimate Rampage. Great, by the way. It's just having people that never wrestle on Dynamite.
It's the alternate preview as well.
No, you can have this one.
No, you can have it. I have to send you a SmackDown for the sake of being fair and equal friendship.
And then we get Red Velvet versus Legit Layla Hirsch.
And God bless the United States.
Chris Hernandez brand from ringside. I don't know. It's felt a bit off. I don't know whether on different...
Because the crowd don't care about women's wrestling, yeah. Because they've been conditioned not to care about women's wrestling for 2.5 years. So despite some pretty damn effective and accomplished and cohesive work, the likes of which Red Velvet should be getting praise because it's an evolution of her... like a professional career, no one gave a toss about it, and it was hard to care about the decent work within this and the tone and the showmanship and the body language. A lot of good things in this match. I can't possibly care about it because it's just so infectious at this point.
I tweeted yesterday complimenting the women's division and they made a goddamn asshole out of me 12 hours later, so I didn't really appreciate that. The death spot is still the death spot when they want it to be the death spot. It's still the Divas division piss break. Adverts, if you happen to be watching this with adverts, cut this to ribbons as well, which didn't help the wrestlers. The Red Velvet one stuck out the most. Like, Layla Hirsch has been getting the shine, and obviously, as kind of talked about on the preview, that feels like the Thunder Rosa thing was a bit of an inconvenience because they wanted to get back to where they were on this run that she was on since breaking away from her friends. But none of it, none of the messaging cut through. The match was neither here nor there because it never really felt focused upon. You were supposed to be paying more attention to the angle and if and when Statlander, because she was banned from ringside, how exactly she would after the fact make her appearance, because you knew she would, because she couldn't in the body of the match itself. It's quite funny. I get this is what I was trying to articulate on Twitter, and I probably didn't do a very good job of it. I think even when the matches suffer or are just not that great, I think they're doing a really good job of giving these women characters. You were really starting to know who all these individual women, and once you've got characters, that's the hard part done. You can bring characters in. I'm really enjoying Layla Hirsch. Like, loves that turnbuckle hook so much. She keeps a spare one just in case. Yes. She can use the sort of Eddie Guerrero, take this one because I'm going to use the other one. That is a character
trait. That was a nice spot. I like that.
Along with the other character traits that you're building up. So you're starting to know all these people, and you know Red Velvet and you know Chris Statlander, and a lot of it was on Dark, but they tried to profile it with graphics and all that. So I really do feel like I want to compliment all this earnest success stuff, but it's going to take so much longer to deal with the big picture problems, and they were at play here. And in the next women's segment on the show, which again was like less than ideal.
Yeah, you said you complimented the women's division that made you look stupid. We've not heard from the world champion yet, so we'll hold breath for that one. Hirsch attacks during Red Velvet's entrance as she stood on the apron, basically, but Velvet takes control. They're bouncing off the barricades and a step-up Hurricane Rana off the steel steps. They finally get in the ring, and the bell actually rings then at that point. Hirsch takes control to take us to a break. When we come back, Velvet just starts kicking her, basically. She counters. Hirsch does a springboard, though, into a German. Velvet comes back, though, hits that mixed kick of hers that finished Layla Hirsch off the other week. Oh, no. Last week. And Hirsch, this time, knows what to do and rolls out of the ring before she can get covered. Goes underneath it, gets the turnbuckle, as you mentioned, but she's got another turnbuckle that she hides in her gear. So the referee takes one and she clonks Red Velvet for the other one. 1, 2, 3. Post-match, Hirsch continues to attack Red Velvet, puts her in the cross-arm breaker, and Chris Statlander, in her new changed gear, comes down to send her packing. We've got Jade Cargill backstage. They're talking about her 30-0 record, the match that's going to seal that, basically. And Jade is not even bothered now about talking about her opponent. She's planning on the celebration. Everything green, bloody Lamborghini, confetti, everything like that. Something better than what Thunder Rosa got, basically, last week. Exotic dancers and a section for her baddies, basically. But she'll take care of whatever she wears. And she, like I said, she just doesn't care who she has to face and who she's going to beat for 30-0. I want to talk next, though, about what happened with Thunder Rosa. They're on the ramp. They do the usual. Tony Schiavone introduces the new AEW Women's World Champion, Thunder Rosa, and she's barely got the mic in her hand. She doesn't get any words out before we get an "excuse me" from Vicky Guerrero. And I thought, okay, right, perfect first opponent for Thunder Rosa, potentially. I love Nyla Rose. It's a shame she's not going to be, you know, genuinely considered as a challenger because it's the first defense, better be ups, and then we'll probably get more, you know, chances of speculating as to whether or not the title will change hands once we get to, you know, the next pay-per-view or whatever. But the fact that you had Vicky Guerrero, of all people, going, you're not from round here, you're Mexican, why don't you take your green card and piss off, basically. And this is all just a spot for distracting her so Nyla Rose can jump her and lay her out and Vicky Guerrero can say Nyla Rose is a true champion. Thunder Rosa versus Nyla Rose on paper is a great match. The way they set this up was dreadful.
It really was. And, you know, there's a lot of, like, low effort, low energy optics at play here. I love Nyla Rose and I like Lance Archer, but you can't stop using the cheat code. Like, I cannot keep watching this Insta feud built up because they're the obvious perfect first challenger. I cannot, like, it's okay for Booker to have the tricks and the tropes, but this one is too transparent and I cannot, like, can't stomach it anymore.
Too overdone.
Yeah, massively. So with the exact wrestlers, no less, not just the actual, like, the plot point. So I felt nothing for this. They don't tell stories of Nyla Rose. They just insert her in this role every now and then they need to. And something I hadn't considered until you were doing your review of it there, was, I really like the Jade Cargill promo. I thought it was really good fun. Like, she just brings this fantastic energy and I just buy what she's selling every single time. But the fact that you packaged all of the woman stuff within like a 25-minute period is a hideous look.
Don't worry, the lads are on for the main event later.
All right, like Jade Cargill, like, was, that was a good segment on its own terms, but the fact you put the three together, like, drags that down off the back of the fact that the other two were pretty lousy. It's really, really disappointing. It is an ugly look that you have the microphone pulled away from Thunder Rosa before she says a word because it's wrestling and we've watched enough wrestling to know that that might mean that they don't have faith in her, which is unfair too.
And the road two, have you seen the road
yeah,
two?
Yeah, unfair too because she can talk. She can, like, either. This was all wrong and the outcome is pretty dispiriting because it's the Nyla Rose match.
How did they do something worse than the cheeseburger celebration?
That's a very good point.
How did they do something worse than that? Yeah, this is ugly for the reasons that everyone's going to point out. This was just marginalised and diminished Thunder Rosa's agency. It's incredibly rote booking that no one's going to care about. All of this is an absolute disaster.
Battle of the Belts is on the like it's potentially going to reek again. Like, if you're thinking this is going to be Colin Page and Nyla Rose and Thunder Rosa, ugh. For the second one in a row.
The worst thing is that this so, like, sort of instantly, infamously bad, this Thunder Rosa and Nyla Rose segment, is that they're making such a big deal out of the Jade Cargill number 30 opponent. They're probably going to bring someone really cool in.
Yeah, exactly.
They've probably got something really cool up their sleeves, but no one's talking about that because they've done something so bad that that's obviously going to dominate the conversation.
Mm. That's going to be fine. Battle of the Belts will be fine because we're going to get the House of Black winning the tag titles.
So yeah, that would be cool.
Don't worry about it.
No, it's Danielson and Mox.
Hey, I thought about them and I thought, oh no, we've got more fun of like recruiting for a bit and then they can win the tag titles.
Battle of the Belts that are covered in cum.
They are doing the speed run rankings climb. Mm. That's a conversation for another day.
Indeed. Main event time. Jericho Appreciation Society, represented by Chris Jericho and Daniel Garcia, versus Dark Order, represented by John Silver and Alex Reynolds. Silver actually out-wrestled Jericho to start with. Took him out with a high kick on the floor, and then there was this mad tope to a suicida brainbuster combo they hit on the outside as well. And I told you about this beforehand. It's early in the morning, so I'm easily bemused. Dark Order pose, and Jericho kicks the steps into what I thought was in frustration and then goes down. And I was like, oh, weren't we meant to see that? What's going on? But of course, I'm an idiot because he's getting Alan Angels and Ten kicked out from ringside by going, oh, and then obviously you've got Cool Hand Ange and Daddy Magic going, oh, he's just bloody sent him into the steps, ref. That's like, there's something that is very close to the three of our hearts. Is, as an English football fan, when a player wants to get his opponent booked and he does the fake waving of the yellow card, it boils our blood. We see it happen in international tournaments all the time when countries play the greatest footballing nation of all time. And this was that in wrestling form, but I adored it obviously because of who was doing it. So yes, they get kicked out from ringside. And still, though, you've got Silver and Reynolds who are making a comeback when we come back from the break. That gets cut off. Jericho goes for the Lion Salt, but Reynolds, who's been isolated for a long time, gets out of the way and finally gets to Silver for the hot tag that we've seen so many times. He runs over everyone in this mad combo of moves, but eventually when he gets back into the ring to face his legal opponent, he gets hit with a code breaker for a two count. Garcia comes in, but Reynolds gets a blind tag, and they hit several great combo offenses to conclude with a diving sort of jackknife pin that gets a two count as well. Again, Silver goes to remove the advantage on the outside by taking out all the rest of the Jericho Appreciation Society, but he gets caught by the big lummox. Jake Hager, who just goes, nope, not a second time, slams him on the floor. And in the ring, Garcia takes the official. As Reynolds comes off the ropes, he gets clonked with Floyd the Bat and gets put in the Scorpion Deathlock for the submission victory for the Jericho Appreciation Society. Sige, I know you loved this main event.
I absolutely loved it. I thought it was absolutely class, completely all action, and it was like an exponential growth chart of pops. Like, it never lulled for a moment. And Chris Jericho, what a finish guy he is. I know sometimes in the singles context, given his advancing, yeah, it's not anymore. Like, he looks 10 years younger. I know that some of his singles matches haven't hit perfectly because of, you know, his age and the wear and tear on his body. I can't think of a single Chris Jericho match in AEW with a finish that wasn't fantastic. Like, he's such a good finish guy. This is such a good finish. Such a severely underrated tag guy. Like, me and Hamflet are we know the truth. We know the goddamn truth. The Hager tag team's great. Did some wonderful stuff with the Sex Gods. What great.
That's obviously where Sammy got it from.
Yeah. The great, great tag team wrestler and finish guy. And this was Young Bucksian in terms of how it was constructed. The John Silver bit. You knew, I was like, he's doing his thing. This is awesome all over again. And then he's like, oh, Hager's there, so you can't do anything to Hager. And oh, he can't because he can get powerbombed. The Hurricane Rana spot was absolutely tremendous. And then John Silver, his whole thing is he's this irrepressible, incorrigible little guy. Doesn't know how small he is. He is, in the end, too small, and Hager just absolutely killed him on the outside. But before that, after he'd done this thing that delighted you, not only do you want him to win, you think he can win, and then he gets hit with the code breaker. Like, Chris Jericho knows how to lay out the goddamn hell of a match, and I thought this was terrific. The finish was great. He's always going to use the bat, and I didn't know that he was going to use the bat because he'd just arranged this match in such a great way that felt like a bastard's trick because he showed so much ass here. It was so selfless. It was like the last refuge of the scoundrel, that finish, and it just came out of nowhere, but in the best possible way because, of course, he was going to do that. Mm-hmm. I thought this was terrific main event professional wrestling.
Yeah, I didn't love this, but I loved how much fun Cedric's had.
That was so good.
Really do. Like, I find that like kind of enthusiasm infectious for a match that was like obviously trending at a certain level anyway, and then it's like, well, can some like listen to that sort of analysis of it can make me think, actually, yeah, I think I did think more of this. I think I was more drawn in at certain points. I have an issue, but it's not specifically isolated to this match. We talked about this before, because I don't really have anything else to add. I thought this was I thought at the time this was a functional main event. Maybe I've been a bit unfair. This is more fun than I could.
I'm the high guy on this. I am the high guy.
I will say, I have a slight issue with Silver and Reynolds, specifically in the Dark Order. They have their cake and eat it too in AEW a lot with these two. You get these matches where Silver especially he just brings so much excitement, like so much dynamism to these matches. And then the commentators are telling you that they're working their way back up the rankings again. But who were the first opponents that were fed to Jurassic Express because they were easy pickings? It was these two.
Mm-hmm.
I don't ever really know quite what to make of these. They're kind of asking me to believe them as main eventers here, as genuine threats to a Chris Jericho tag team, brand new stable tag team at that. And then in the body of the match, you get all these moments where you're like, oh yeah, they are a threat. They're not really a threat. So I kind of don't really know where to take the Dark Order at this point. If they're so great, why didn't Hangman Page pick them in the first place? Start asking other questions about where exactly they fit in at the moment. But the work, objectively, of course, was tremendous at points.
Really enjoyable main event. And like I say, a near-perfect Dynamite, aside from some flaws in the middle there. But do let us know your thoughts on Twitter, at WhatCultureWWE. Watch today. You can follow all three of us. You can follow Michael Hamflet at...
Michael Hamflet.
Follow Michael Sidgwick at...
M. Sidgwick.
And if you haven't done so already, what are you bloody playing at? Order Becoming, All Elite, The Rise of AEW on Amazon, if you want to. If you want to do as well, get some beers in time for WrestleMania, you can do so from our friends at Top Rope Brewing, including our very own clickbait thumbnail named by the brilliant Michael Sidgwick. It's a 5.1% YPA. You can get that along with 11 other delicious beers for the low, low price of £45, including free shipping if you enter the code Here's Why at checkout. Again, apologies to our international listeners, but this is only for our European listeners. You can get them right now at topropebrewing.com. Make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling wherever you get your podcast from for daily wrestling podcasts, of course, as I mentioned, with the AEW Rampage preview coming tomorrow too. But for now, this has been the AEW Dynamite Review. My thanks to the Dudley Boys. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.